everyone, and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave, a podcast based on the works of George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series. Today, we are taking a little bit of a different tact, and we are looking at some of the writing conventions in Martin's series, and in particular, the five-year gap. We want to discuss whether or not the five-year gap was an important feature of the story that has been lost and what its change may have impacted. Joining me today is Greg.
Hello, this is Greg, Claudius the Fool on the forums.
Zach.
Hi, this is Zach, alias in the forums.
And Bina.
Hi, everyone. This is Bina 007 on the forums.
And today I'll be your host, Stephen or SJ Lee on the forums. So I suppose the first thing we should do is explain what the five-year gap is for those who may not be aware. The five-year gap was a strategy George developed as he was writing A Song of Ice and Fire. The original plan was once he completed A Storm of Swords that 5 years would elapse in the story before the next book. To allow characters to age up for pieces to move into place and advance the story chronologically. However, he found that the story wasn't really developing in the direction that he wanted, and he found he couldn't reflexively recall what had happened over the preceding 5 years in a way that he satisfied it, so he scrapped it, which dramatically changed the course of the series, and that's something I'd like to discuss with you guys today.
I'd like to get into the motivation a little bit, because this is something you randomly tweeted me about, and then we're like, okay, we should talk about this, but why specifically, Stephen, are you so interested in it? Or what has been bugging you when you said, I really want to chat about this?
You're right. It did come up on Twitter. I was actually talking to some fellow VOK hosts about this online, and a number of issues came up in a row about how both the books and the TV series was going. And even some of it was speculating why we thought Winds of Winter was taking a long time to be released. And part of it is, I think that if you look at how the timeline has evolved, by getting rid of this, the elapse of time, certain characters are just very young and certain ideas are just very underdeveloped. So because things are kind of advancing linearly, I think we estimate as a fandom that about 2.5 years elapse from the start of Game of Thrones to the end of A Storm of Swords. And so we are not seeing a tremendous amount of time moving forward. So the Stark children are still children. Dany is still very young. And so things sometimes feel like they're moving very quickly. And the plot isn't really advancing, I think, in a steady rate.
No, it is very shocking how slow it is. We were doing the linear reread where Catelyn and Rob come back to the Whispering Wood and they're reminiscing. They're just on their way to the Red Wedding and they're reminiscing of the battle won the last time they were there, which was only 11 months previously. And we're halfway through A Storm of Swords and the last time they were in the Whispering Wood was Game of Thrones. So I was really shocked. I kind of figured it would have been earlier in Storm of Swords. Like, you just forget how micro-paced these books are. It's quite unusual, I find, for fantasy. Although, I mean, I guess Lord of the Rings all takes place over pretty much 18 months, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, the story proper, like not counting the weird, you know, like the 18-year chapter one.
Yeah, exactly.
but call me ignorant, but like I didn't think that much time passed between the first three books. It's 2.5 years in the first three books?
Yeah.
That's the number you gave me, is that right?
Yeah, because I think what happens
seems much
is,
less than that to me. But
I think the actual story proper is more like 18 months, but if you remember from the linear reread, there's the first few Dany chapters that happen almost 6 to 9 months before the kind of Winterfell, kind of where we think of the start of the books, which is Robert going up the King's Road.
But when we're reading those books, like, for me at least, I didn't realize that Dany was so spread out, you know, before the others. So, like, in my head, it seems like it's a much more condensed story.
Yeah.
And 2 years seems more like for the whole five books so far.
It's just Dany, basically, all her Game of Thrones chapters happen and are done a good 9 months before Game of Thrones even begins. So, yeah, that is distorting.
A damn linear reread causing problems again.
It just exposes stuff. I mean, sometimes there are episodes where you think it didn't really make much difference to do it in the linear order. But there are occasions when it does highlight a lot of the pacing issues that I guess we'll get into today.
Just to speak generally about the issue of the micro-pacing that we do feel as we go through the series, I think it's just a symptom of the fact that it's obviously very easy to get caught in the weeds as a writer, and I think obviously that's the thing that George gets in trouble with a lot. But it's clear, especially knowing that he had this five-year gap plan, that he was conscious of that, he wanted to get out of that. But I think the particular complication, obviously, with this series is that there's so many characters and so many timelines to manage that while it's true that with most most stories, the only way to really make it work in a reasonable amount of time is to take time skips throughout and to kind of progress things in a faster way where appropriate. It just became so much of an issue every time any character was kind of rubbing up against another one figuratively, and they just couldn't align all these disparate timelines.
When did we find out about the 5-year gap as a fandom? Because like I assume it was sometime after he was done with Storm when there was the big wait between 3 and 4. Is that correct? Because I wasn't reading the books then, so I don't know.
I don't know when we learned about the 5-year gap, but I would have to. So a lot of my knowledge about this comes from a particular interview by, hold on, let me get the author's name, Charlie Jane Anders, where she asks about the 5-year gap in a detailed explanation. And it's a nice, concise explanation by George of what the plan was. And initially, there had been no plan for a gap because the story was supposed to advance much more quickly in terms of time. So, at the end of A Game of Thrones, Bran should have been, say, 9 or 9.5 instead of being, something like that, right? Like, he starts the book, he's almost 8 or something.
Nearly a man grown.
Yeah.
He's 7 when he starts, right? So, yeah, 8.
Sure, so. Yeah. We check in with him when they find the wolves, and then it's 6 months later and something else happens, and then it's 3 months later. So time was supposed to move much more quickly in that sense. And George found as he was writing that he was kind of, as we've discovered with the linear reread, almost writing like day by day or week by week. And so you don't make a lot of forward progression through time. So then the 5-year gap was developed because he's like, well, I still want to cover all of this time. But he abandoned it because, according to him, it worked for some characters and didn't with others, which I actually think is a poor conclusion to come to. And he found he had to do a lot of retroactive explanation.
Like flashbacks and stuff like that.
What was interesting to me is that given the decision he was kind of forced into with Feast Dance of only doing certain characters in one book and the others in the other, that he didn't decide to then have the next book being 2 books. But kind of sequential in time, and then do the adult characters first and show them kind of progressing in real time, but not really, I don't know how easy that would have been, but not sort of mention the others, but then come back to them in a book later to have given himself an extra year or so. But I guess that wouldn't have been enough time either. That would only have, if he'd have kept the same pacing, that would only have bought him a year.
It seems almost that once he decided to abandon the gap, that it was going to suck one way or the other, and he just accepted the fact that it's just going to take longer to tell the story.
Yeah,
which I would have thought, like, he mentions that he doesn't, in that letter that you linked to, the letter from his editor from, like, 93 before the series was written, just the proposal, where he says that he doesn't, he's like, as you know, I don't outline my stories, but part of me thinks that might be part of why this is an issue, where if he had outlined more or just thought more specifically, I don't know how detailed he does, I assume to some degree, then he would have known that this would have been a problem, but the story grows in the telling, and I know that. And it just seems like, he talks about having Cersei doing flashbacks to what happened in the previous 5 years, and that would have just made too much sense to pack all that into like one chapter of Cersei.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
I completely disagree with that because based on that logic, he should have begun the books at the start of Robert's Rebellion. He had to tell us all about Robert's Rebellion in the last, 14 years retroactively, and all of what the characters had been doing in the whole period. Like, it described their entire lives. Would it have been so different for...
Well, that's in the past, though. That's in the past when the story starts. He's not telling the story of Robert's Rebellion. He's telling the story of what came after.
Sure. But if you're talking about, Cersei's regency, and it's been 5 years, and it's been this brutal period for King's Landing and the area she controls, there's no reason why... like, she can't reflect on that time period, because we kind of get that anyway when we start getting her POV characters and she's reflecting on what happened in the previous books.
I think the ultimate question there in that particular case is it more interesting for her to reflect on these things, or is it more interesting for her to experience them? If all the interesting things in Cersei's storyline have already happened, why would we even bother to follow her as a character?
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think that he seems to always be coming at it from the Stark children point of view, and that gap made much more sense from the children's point of view, which we mentioned with, certain things that they have to do, they can't do when they're 6 and 7, but they could do when they're 14 and 15. And maybe he was more focused on them instead of the larger characters as a whole. But I understand what you're saying, Stephen. I'm not disagreeing specifically. It's more just in a broad sense. Like, it's we find out about Robert's Rebellion in like little sentences or like a flashback, but not like we don't get like a whole 4 chapters on this happened, which is what I think he would have to do, filling in 5 years of King's Landing politics, in a couple Cersei chapters. Just my two cents.
I suppose I just can imagine how it would work, even. You know, say the prologue for Feast for Crows is some Gold Cloak's perspective on, like, the kind of tyranny that he has to enforce and what conditions are like in the series, in the city. And then, like, okay, now we're set up for what conditions are like here to move forward. And then, yeah, obviously he dies because it's a prologue character chapter. Like, he dies at the hand of, like, this growing angry mob of, you know, maybe it's the sparrows or just, like, the small folk who, you know, if a guard is caught in an alley at night, they're going to take him out.
Yeah, you can do it with a bridging chapter. I was thinking, I mean, some of you guys were mentioning other sort of sci-fi or fantasy series that have breaks because it's very common to have time skips. And I was thinking of War and Peace, which is another sprawling epic with millions of, not millions, but certainly tens.
Classic of science fiction literature.
Yeah, but tens and tens of characters. Yeah. And they do start off with the protagonist, Natasha, as a young sort of Sansa-aged girl. But at the end, she's going to be a wife and mother. And they do have these time skips. And the way Tulsa does it, he almost has the sort of an authorial historical chapter every now and then that just gives his view on what has happened and the state of the nation. And some people find that clumsy. I find that kind of cool, and that's part of the way that novel works so well. But there are obviously devices and ways in which you could have done it. But I don't know. I just think that in a sense, it's not the technical problem of how to do it, but that George is so, maybe not in love anymore, but so wedded to these characters and can see so clearly the individual kind of day-by-day pacing that he does struggle to lift himself up to 20,000 feet rather than staying in the weeds as he put it. Because he's obviously talented enough to have done it if he really, really wanted to, but felt he didn't want to make that choice. It feels to me anyway.
So I guess that's the big question, right? Do you guys feel confident that the story would be more interesting if we picked up with these characters 5 years later in many cases? So, I mean, we talked about the Cersei case, and I do actually think, as much as George says that one couldn't possibly work, that would be really cool if we picked up on Cersei after 5 years of having to deal with all the conflicts in King's Landing and seeing this religious rebellion fomenting over that long period of
100%.
Time. It would have a lot more weight to it. But,
yeah.
But then I look at characters that I think traditionally you would say, yes, the 5-year gap would have been perfect for them, like Daenerys and Jon. Obviously, you would think, yes, it would be interesting to pick up with them 5 years down the line and see where they're at after being Lord Commander or ruler of Meereen, or, you know, having these responsibilities and seeing how they've grown and changed. But I think that, you know, as much as we might decry, like, their, like, excessive amount of chapters in A Dance with Dragons developing those early days of them learning how to rule, I feel like that's kind of essential to their development, is learning how they transition from that point before where they don't have the same kind of authority and responsibility, and, like, seeing them first have to deal with that as opposed to them kind of being more world weary and experienced. I you know, there's interesting stuff there too, but I don't know. I feel like that part is, like, kind of essential to how I see those characters now.
Yeah, it is. But, like, also, what do people complain most about in Dance and Feast? They complain about Jon and they complain about Dany. All that stuff.
You're right, they do.
Yeah, and I just feel that for a writer as talented as George, there must be a way of conveying that slow struggle to learn and experimenting with rule and getting it wrong. There must be a way of doing that in a more concise manner. And maybe this is a question of editorial control and the editor having more input than evidently was the case in Feast Dance. I feel it could be done. I agree with you that in terms of world building, it all helps, and character building maybe as well. But it just feels like if he had even just maybe he wouldn't have needed the 5-year gap. If he had just taken longer to hit exactly the same linear plot points, so it just takes longer for rebellions to ferment and plots to come to fruition rather than day by day, month by month, and year by year, then already actually they would have had more credibility and you would have aged up people anyway. Like, to me, it was always incredible that Jon would be so young as Lord Commander. If the plot that he had gone through had just been much more spaced, it would be better. And I think the same with Dany, the same with a lot of other characters. It's almost like he's written in a tightly bound concertina, and he just needed to have stretched it all out a little bit more. But easy to be said in retrospect, I guess.
I guess for me, the consideration of whether or not, you know, their age is relevant to the experience they're having, or if it, you know, it works, is less important to me than the plot working and it being interesting. I do think there's a lot of reasons why it would have been beneficial to skip ahead and sort of see these characters at in media res point as they're, you know, in the middle of these journeys. But for me, it's less important that they're older. I don't know. I understand why that, you know, the suspension of disbelief is needed, but that's just, like, not high on my priority list of how this would have been helpful.
I think it sort of just makes certain, I think it leads him into certain emotional responses and effects that maybe he doesn't want to get into. I mean, I think the Mercy chapter is the ultimate classic example of that, right? But even in terms of where Sansa is with whatever horrible sexual thing is going to happen to her in the next book, or I don't know. I think it just it has shoehorned him into certain things. I think you can feel that he feels constrained, and I wonder if that is part of the... This is a guy who loves writing in this world, but he's obviously struggling, and I wonder if that's part of it.
That is definitely true, particularly of Sansa and Arya, for sure.
And even the Age of the Dragons, to be honest. I mean, as fighting forces of maturity.
Right. I think Bina, there you hit on kind of a big point I want to touch with this one. And that is, aside from the characters, which is obviously the most important part of how the five-year gap would play out, there are aspects to the world that they feel rushed. So one, the development of the dragons, it's supposed to take years and years, but because of the pacing of the story, I think George forced them to grow faster than they should have. Like, to me, like, it should take a decade for them to be the right size. So if Dany showed up in Westeros with undersized, like, juvenile dragons, that makes a lot of sense. But I really think he basically, like, sprinkled some literary growth hormone on them to get them the right size by the end of A Dance with Dragons.
Well, the show copied him exactly with that. So they followed George word for word in the TV show.
The other big thing that I've been thinking a lot about is a huge deal is made of the story, particularly early on, about how long the summer has been. And everyone is bracing themselves for a long and terrible winter. But if the story plays out in kind of the pace that we have had so far, that winter will only last probably a couple of years if the defeat of the others leads to an end of winter. Mm-hmm. So there's this big, like, narrative cloud that's been looming over the city, this winter without end. And it will be one of the shortest ones in recent history, because it should be a 10-year long winter, right? There's supposed to be some sort of rough parallel between the summers and the winters. And we're not going to get that because there's time. But if you had the 5-year gap.
Do we know that he's not going to put in... He's obviously... We know that he hasn't put in a 5-year gap where he thought he would, but...
5-year gap where Davos is just sitting on Skagos for 5 years? I can't wait to read that.
I do think when we get to Winds of Winter, there will be greater time between chapters because winter will slow things down.
Yeah, for sure.
See, I think the opposite. I think that, like, so much stuff is coming to a head that he can't take a gap now with... Unless, like, he resolves the battle and then there's, like, a section one, section two type thing, you know?
I
feel like it's too late for a gap. It's just too late. And the short winter will hopefully be because they defeat the others and then summer comes, or spring, sorry.
Yeah, he can make some in-world reason why everyone was fearing a long winter, but it's actually short. Yeah. Dragon mechanics, you know?
And there's also the consequences of the wars, right? Medieval warfare often stretched years and years and years, but these ones seem to wrap up really quickly just for the
decades
sake of
decades and decades and decades.
Yeah.
And also history shows, I mean, like, rebellions, houses coming to power, deals being done usually takes months and years. Even in modern history, you know, Hitler comes to power in 33, World War II isn't until 1939. You know, these things don't just happen overnight.
It's fantasy, Bina. It's fantasy.
I know. But it's a fantasy series that I admire because it is so real in its motivations and the power. You know, I think the strength of it is that a lot of it is, it's fantasy, but it's kind of credible in the human nature and the mechanics of it. So it saddens me when it isn't.
Yeah, well, you look at the original proposal, he was like, three books, you know, first book is the internecine house fighting between the Starks and the Lannisters, second book is the Dothraki invasion, and third book is the epic battle between the others and everybody else. And I always try to think the big picture plot, like, the big picture plot is not what's going on in King's Landing, it's the others, like, that's the big bad guys, and that's 100%. What everything's leading towards. And that would have definitely benefited from a 5-year gap, because you can get rid of all the stuff, the politics, you know, the backstabbing, and then you can bring those two things together. But now I feel like it's almost impossible to make everything work out from a plotting point of view correctly. Like, he's going to have to sacrifice some things. And he did that in Dance and in Feast. And I think he's going to have to do that in Winds to get to whatever the seventh book, if it's going to be seven, because now who knows? You know, he said then it's going to be three, then five, and now nine.
I don't understand. But, it kind of feels we're 2/3 of the way through, like we're entering the third act.
It's also
sometimes it only feels like we're halfway through.
Yeah, true.
And, like, I know you mentioned, like, why he could divide it up again and do, like, a kind of a feast dance for Windspring, but I honestly think that it's a lot to ask of the readers. Not that he owes us anything, you know, we're the readers, he's the artist, he's the creator. But when people have put in their, you know, time, money, life into these books, you expect you expect to pay off, and now to be told that it might be 5 or 10 years away, that's a lot to ask for some people. I don't care. I'm going to read them no matter what. But I have people who come into the bookstore and they're like, I'm done with this book. You know, I'm done with the series. You know,
I strongly believe that it weren't for this community that has kept me going and kept me interested, I would have just sort of faded away from the series.
And I've burned out a lot, you know, at points, and I wouldn't be starting a new epic fantasy series if I knew that this book was coming out soon.
Yeah, I do make that a new rule. Like, when people now recommend me stuff, like someone recommended me a Patrick Rothfuss book, and I was like, if this is not already finished, do not recommend it to me.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people with that rule now.
Yeah, I don't have the emotional bandwidth to be left hanging by another author.
It is George has been cursed by his own success. He's written
the TV show is a huge part of that. We've only touched on that, but the TV show has just made everything times 10, where before it could just be with him and some people posting on Westeros or the forums, and you know, but now it's the fandom it's millions.
That's quite literally the largest show ever, right?
Certainly added to the pressure on him. So if he's a writer, he doesn't respond well to pressure, then the show is probably crippling. So that's very sad. And it does sadden me. Like, I mean, I've become a bit bitter and cynical, but he has given us so much joy. He evidently had great joy in writing these. If he no longer has the joy of it, then that's an awful thing.
Yeah.
I think I would be more disappointed, and it almost feels inevitable at this point, if we were rushed to a conclusion as mm-hmm. opposed to not getting one. And I feel like that, you know, without spoiling it, that is what we're getting with the TV show right now, is that, you know, they're kind of just like going through these plot points, you know, one after the other. And it feels like the characters aren't really even characters anymore. They're just kind of these automatons moving from plot point to make sure we get there. And I just don't want to see that happen with the books too. And it feels like just so much needs to happen from this point at the end of A Dance with Dragons up to, you know, the sort of things we know need to happen, that I'm worried that the same thing's going to happen. That's going to be the case.
Yeah. I agree 100%, Zach. And when I was watching the new episode so far, and yes, Bina, I know I will not say anything specific, but it very much felt like if the four of us sat down and said, okay, let's speculate how the series moves from where it is at the end of book 5 to the conclusion we all assume is coming in broad strokes, who needs to go where and do what? And instead of having, you know, long chapters and interesting writing, it's just like, here's our outline. And the outline is now what's being presented on television. It feels very like, you guys are getting exactly what you want. Here it is. Mm-hmm. But it feels hollow.
And that's the reality, isn't it? Actually, I don't want the show version, which is where you rush through plot, 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 and you're done. And I don't want the kind of feast dance, endless character development at micro pace. I want George to tell it in his own way. And well edited, like better edited than Dance. And if that takes another 3 or 4 books, fine. But what makes me nervous is if the gaps are all going to be 7 years, there isn't time for 3 or 4 books. I think we're going to end up with the worst of all worlds, where even he feels that. So it is wrapped up in 2 books, and therefore it is a bit rushed. Because if he'd have started earlier, he could have finished this at the same micro pace.
Part of me feels like we're past the point of getting a resolution while the TV show's still on, because either way, the TV show's done next year. The Song of Ice and Fire, there might be prequels and sequels, whatever, but that's done in 2018. And from his point of view, like, it makes more sense to just wait out the year and a half or 2 years, whatever it is, and then in 2019 put out the book. You know, the fandom has cooled down a bit, and he can tell it at his own pace and on his own level. And I would hate that to have to wait 2 more years, but, you know, realistically, it's not coming out this year. It's probably going to be 2019, 2020 anyway. And surprise me if I'm wrong.
See, what makes me know, I think you're right. What I hope is that he's not pausing to write it till the show's over. And there's a difference.
Well, I hope he's always writing. I mean, he should always. I mean, I assume writers write, you know, all the time.
But not necessarily on this. It might be Fire and Blood Part 2.
I evolved from 2012 to be like, let him take as long as he wants. And then I was like angry. And now I'm like, of course, let him take as long as he wants, because I want a good product.
Yeah, and that's the worst. They want the worst of all worlds, where you wait till 2019, but it's still like Dance. I'd rather then wait till 2021 and get it well edited.
8 years in between at that point. And I you know, because I think he'll lose people if that's the fact. You know, the first 3 books were so, they were paced. They were almost perfect in from a narrative point of view, and the last 2 were not. I still love them.
What were the gaps between Game of Thrones and Clash of Kings, and then Clash of Kings and Storm?
Publishing wise?
Yeah, how long do people have to wait for those?
It was 96, 99, and 2000.
That's perfect, isn't it?
But I assume he had been writing those books for years before, you know, bits and pieces. It's not like he just sat down one day and, okay, now I'm starting Clash, you know, and I think he had, you know, parts. He didn't, I hope, I don't think he wrote, you know, 900 pages in
In fact, he didn't, because if you read the interview that Stephen's posted in the show notes, he says, my original concept back in 99 was, I'd start this way. So he's obviously been mulling it over for 5 years before it came out, the first book. So.
Right. The first book was supposed to end with the Red Wedding.
This is why there's no way there's just two books left, right?
I mean, which if you look at if you all cast your gaze to your bookshelf and look at the thickness of a Game of Thrones, a Clash of Kings, and a Storm of Swords together and say, yeah, that was supposed to be one book, you kind of get the sense of it.
Yeah,
Greg, I think I've gone through a similar evolution with my expectations about Martin and his writing. The one thing I will say is I think I'm a little more defensive of Martin. I really bristle at fans that seem to be becoming more bitter and angry about this.
And I hope that's not how I was coming off from a personal, like, George should take as long as he wants to write. I'm talking more from the publishing marketing side, like having two more world books, I think, is a disservice to the fans who have been waiting for so long. But of course, they're in the business to make money.
So I do sound like that, Stephen, and I know why you're defensive, because that's how I used to be, and I wish I still were. I'm just not a good enough person. Like, I can feel...
Oh, Venus, too honest.
No, I can. I can just feel it taking over me, this anger, and I can't stop it. And I do feel like the intellectual part of me is like, he's an artist, he is, there's nothing. I'd rather get the creation he wants to give us, even if that takes a decade. And yet the sort of the inner sort of, you know, emotional part of me is like, no, you do owe me something. I devoted a lot of my life to this. As if other people were waiting, stop dicking around with fire and blood and write the book we want. So I totally get why you'd be defensive. I don't, and I hate when I do come off as angry as I'm now becoming, because I love.
And also, you're a writer, Stephen. You're professionally, personally, I'm not. So I always try to be very careful when I talk from a creative point of view, because I don't really do that. So
that's actually something I wanted to bring up. I write for pleasure. I write fiction for pleasure, and recently I've started doing more collaborative work, which has given me some sort of thought of what might be working on George's mind. When people take my characters and my settings and do things with them I don't like, it really puts me off the project.
Wow. You're writing a children's book, Stephen, and having trouble with an illustrator.
Indeed. Martin has given a number of interviews over the years, especially around season 5, when there were a number of dramatic changes that upset members of the book fandom and also Martin, I believe, where he's like, the show is doing things differently than I intend them to be done. So I wonder if he needs creative distance from the A Song of Ice and Fire narrative series, and his creative energies are being diverted more into things like Duncan Egg or, you know, Fire and Blood or, God forgive us, Wild Cards, because he doesn't have full control at the moment, and it doesn't feel good to play with your characters when someone's messing around in your sandbox and knocking over your castles.
That's so sad.
I think it's a combination of that and just the simple fact, and, you know, as much as he may deny it, I'm sure it must be, maybe not fully consciously, but it must be debilitating to know that the story is going to be told before you have a chance to tell it. You know, the things that you want to share with people are already out there in the world. Like,
but
it's not
again,
it's just not going to have the same gravity and weight. It's going to naturally be less, you know, interesting to him to tell that story.
Let me play a little bit devil's advocate here.
I think I'll join you, Bina, on your devil's advocate.
Because he was not forced to sell the show. He chose to sell the show. And he could have chosen to sell the show whereby there was a clause that they couldn't go further than the books, and maybe they would have chosen to walk away from that. Or he could have written T-Wow while the show was going on. But he was not hard up. He was not a poor author. He was widely published. He had TV scripts done. It's not like he needed the money. More money is always good. I'm a greedy capitalist. I get that. But it, to me, it's tremendously emotionally sad if other people writing fanfic about your works has put you off going back to those works. But he made that choice, and he had a long history in the 80s in TV, right? So he knows how TV works. He's not like a pure author who's never sold TV and then gets screwed over with the first TV deal. I mean, this is a guy who should have known a little bit the ramifications of it. So,
no, absolutely.
You know, he takes the fat cash, you get the consequences, no?
Right, but we as a fandom are also dealing with those consequences. And I think there's an element of...
We didn't get the fat cash.
No, we don't get the fat cash. We just get, you know, hundreds of hours of entertainment and immensely pleasurable books to read and an insufferable wait time. Like, that's the deal with the devil we made on this one. And, you know, I don't know if a person can't take the money, say this was a great business decision, and then in his heart of hearts be a little conflicted. And do we feel sorry for him for his dump trucks of money? No. but does it hurt his ability to creatively produce? I will say from my recent experiences, it is a little hard to have someone else using your material.
I think it must be very hard. Very hard.
I would assume that is the case. I mean, I always take everything back to Tolkien. I'm like, the difference with Tolkien and Martin is that like Tolkien wrote those books over, you know, 25, 30 years. They were pretty much done in 1954. And then they both came out, or all three came out over a very short period. So like, but if in 1954, like he did, you know, Fellowship, and then the BBC was like, oh, we're going to do this as a radio drama. 20 million people are going to listen to it. And then they do their own ending. He might never put out the last two books, you know, because he would have had to rewrite everything.
Yeah.
And that would have been awful. But like for this, like, I understand what Bina's saying. I understand what Steven's saying, but I come more on Bina's side just because like, unless he was totally underestimating his, he's like, oh, I'm definitely going to get wins done in a couple of years. He knew where he was at that point. You know, we all heard that he already had 200 pages written and all that. And something has happened. You know, the show is the big thing that's happened to cause him to.
And in fairness to him, the hugeness of the show maybe would have been a surprise.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He could have under, because I mean, it is the big, and they did not know that it would be the biggest show ever in 2010. You know, no one did. I remember, and, you know, it was just another sci-fi fantasy show. Oh, this will be fun. But it just,
and of course, he underestimated how long it would take. I think that's self-evident. I'm surprised that you think that wouldn't be the case. I mean, when the ball got rolling with a show back in like 2006, when he first had a conversation with David Benioff, he must have thought that he would have the books out before the show, you know, ever got going. I don't think.
No, there I was thinking that, more 20, like show came out in 2011, right?
Yeah.
But, it was the summer that Dance came out. So I was thinking more like 2010, sure. 2011, like, oh, Wins is going to be done and I'll be done in by 2015. Yeah. 2015 seems so far in the future. In 2010. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he had already made the investment beforehand. But yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he must have been convinced he could have beat the show at any point in that time. Maybe not in the past 3 years. That's probably the point where he realized, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. No. But yeah, I think he must have thought he could beat them.
Just turn a little bit back towards a 5-year gap. Oh, yeah. I think this is intimately tied with what we're talking about here, because George's central problem has always seemed to be aligning his timelines and getting things to play out the way he needs them to. And for example, with the Dance of Dragons, the big holdup there was the Myrinese blot, right? Or not, sorry, the blot is the block. The Myrinese knot, trying to get all the characters at the right place at the right time, and who arrives when, and how does that affect the story? And from what I've read about his writing, he's constantly had to go back and revise to like tinker with who's where, when, and, you know, what condition they are in. So really, like, time is kind of the biggest factor, I think, in shaping the story so far. What do you guys think?
Nobody wants to go.
No one.
You were too erudite and on point with that.
I think you're completely, I agree, basically.
I think we're all right.
Aren't we all right, really, when we think about it? So the other aspect of this I think we should consider is, while I really like A Feast for Crows, though I haven't given it a proper reread yet, Feast for Crows and Dance of Dragons are probably among the least loved books in the series, and they are a consequence of skipping the 5-year gap. Do we have any thoughts on that in particular?
Well, it's unusual, I just from what I've read, just like other books that I've read, to split a book from a character perspective, I believe. Not so much the gap, you know, but some people had to wait, you know, what, 10 years to go from like John to John or Bran to Bran, you know, at the characters that didn't appear in Feast, which would be very jarring for me. But, you know, I didn't care because I just got to pick up the next book the second I finished it. But I think he thought it was the best decision of some several crappy decisions he had to make, and he did the best he could. And if he wasn't doing the gap, he had to do that, right?
I'll just say that there's obviously in at least this more invested fandom of which we're a part of, a lot of people that would say that, maybe not that they're the best books, but that A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons are very good books. You know, they kind of point out all these like cool scenes that we get, the good writing and different characters and interesting journeys. I'm not one of those people. I'm not really a fan of either of those books. In fact, it took me a very long time to get through A Feast for Crows because I really just didn't enjoy it the first time through. But I think that especially after having, you know, watched where the show is at now, where, as I said before, things are kind of rushing right along plot point to plot point, I am starting to appreciate more. And again, I don't think that those books were the right way to do it. There's a lot of plot lines that I think just still don't need to be there. I've started to get more of this appreciation for taking your time with things and getting these characters in the middle of their journeys, as, you know, romantic and interesting and enticing as that sounds in the 5-year gap context. I do appreciate, you know, the point at the journeys we get to explore spoil out of these characters more so now. But I just, again, the overall concern that, you know, kind of overrides that is that it's going to be rushed eventually unless we get a million more books to get us through everything else at that same pace. It's just like it can be slow and, you know, a micro pace now, but it can't stay that way if this is ever going to end. So that's the ultimate frustration with it.
Yeah, this is not sustainable, right? This cannot stand. And I think he gets that. I never thought about it that way before, but I really believe you guys are right that he needs to see out the show to get his creative juices back. He just needs to get over that, and maybe then the frequency will increase, but that's still a long wait.
But what's on the heels of Game of Thrones is prequels and sequels that he's going to be involved in on level. And not, I know, I'm just mentioning it because
it's
true. I don't think he'll ever escape it 100%, no. But, you know, he'll hopefully get to a point where he can separate enough to do it. And maybe he's been doing it this whole time and he's fooling everybody. Good for him. I just don't think that's the case.
Bean, I think when we were talking before and you were mentioning how he should have just advanced time more quickly, spaced events, you know, have it been, you know, months apart rather than days apart, and that would have fixed the series from the beginning. That, I think, is the perfect solution, but we're already so deep in, that's obviously can't happen now. But what I would say is I think, you know, maybe instead of a 5-year gap, he needs to do something more like a 3-year slip. Which is, you know, imagine if Feast for Crows and Dance of Dragons covered 3 years of time instead of maybe the year it actually does. So some things are just going to move along more quickly. But more is going to push forward in time. Arya is going to be older. Bran will be older. Sansa will be older. So it makes sense that they're starting to take on these new responsibilities that they've trained more thoroughly. And
so essentially what you're suggesting is, you know, not one big skip, but little skips from chapter to chapter as things progress more quickly.
Which is kind of in your interview what he was suggesting the 1991 concept was, that there would be these little sort of maybe 6-month skips between chapters or 3-month skips so that people, we're just aging up more quickly.
Yeah, but I think now because he didn't do it in the middle books, that it'll be harder to do that in the late books.
Well, look at, I mean, Dune is a good comparison because, I mean, the 6 Dune books that Frank Herbert actually wrote, the first one is like its own self-contained story. Then there's about a 10 or 15 gap between 1 and 2. And then there's like another gap between 2 and 3. And then there's a 1,000-year gap between 4 and 5 or 5 and 6. I'm drawing a blank. But as long as you tell a concise story within the books and don't leave people hanging too much, they'll be fine with that. The problem is what I think he did is that he literally left, you know, the mother of all, you know, Hank cliffhangers at the end of book 5, you know, and people aren't satisfied by that. And, you know, there's plenty of examples in fiction where you can have gaps, and, you know, the Ender's Game where like there's, you know, because of like the time, you know, the faster than light travel, like the books do skip thousands of years, but in relative terms, it's only 20 years and they're done fine. And I wasn't complaining about that. You know, maybe people were, but it's fine from a narrative point of view, but it's because we're all involved in this as they're being written over a 20-year period that all this can be focused on, you know.
Absolutely.
I still comes down to outlining. Maybe you can speak more from the Stephen and Zach, because you guys you write. But if he outlined more, do you think this would not be a problem or as big a problem?
I think it's much easier for him to get in the trap of wanting to say tell every single thing, you know, like what exactly happens next in every character's arc if he doesn't have an outline, if he doesn't have a clear point of where he wants to get, because the natural inclination is to be like, all right, the character is here, so then he goes there next. You don't kind of make that more sort of higher level decision making and storytelling to say, well, he doesn't need to go there necessarily because it's not, you know, it's not important to his overall story. Obviously, he does have some sense, I think, of what these overall stories are, and for me the bigger issue is not that, you know, I think it was in the beginning, it's what made a Game of Thrones so much longer, it's what turned that from one book to 3 books, but I think the bigger issue at this point is just the sheer amount of characters he has to manage within some kind of, you know, some kind of cohesive timeline.
Well, Greg, if you want my thoughts on in length on writing, you could listen to VOK 63 Writer's Workshop. But
of course, I've listened to every single VOK, Stephen. I don't know what you're implying.
Of course,
that was
4
years ago.
Yeah, 2014. I have it pulled up just because I didn't know the episode number. But what I will say is there's kind of a school of thought that writers are generally divided, and I think George's terms are gardeners and architects. An architect rigorously plans every aspect of the story and then sort of implements it. George considers himself a gardener, where he plants seeds for ideas and nurtures them and sees what they turn into, which is why he probably has to write, rewrite, and scrap chapters so often, because, you know, maybe his, you know, the story of Arianne in the Stormlands isn't really working the way he wants, so that has to go back to do something else, right? I think most writers realize they're somewhere on a spectrum, and even the most gardener of a writer needs to have some sort of plan, because unless you're writing like very short poetry, you can't just like stream of consciousness write a novel. It's not possible.
Especially with this many characters, right? And this many locations. And it just feels like even if we're, I mean, I think we're 2/3 of the way through, potentially we're halfway way through. It just feels like things are still sort of multiplying rather than being brought in and being brought together. And I think the emergence in some of the preview chapters of Euron as this ultimate Cthulhu type evil guy. So late in the day, we're being given these very dominant, apparently quite dominant, not new characters, but new forces in this world. And that's what worries me a little bit, because it still feels like it's broadening out rather than narrowing in at this relatively
late. Parts are definitely, parts are broadening it, but like we know that there has been a battle in the north. We just don't know the outcome. And we know that the battle, you know, fire is literally happening. True. So like those things will be resolved very relatively shortly. But just always think of the big picture. They don't mean much in the big picture. It's getting Dany to Westeros to fight the others. Like that's, and Jon, that's what it's, we assume it's all leading towards. Not that I'm saying we'll know. But like you mentioned it before, you know, Stephen, but like about how the TV show is like almost making it like they're caricatures of the characters, like we're doing this and then this. Like I remember talking about it probably before season four, but like there's only so many ways it can end, you know, and someone has guessed correctly on all of them between everyone out there. You know, someone knows, they might not know it, but that's how the series is going to end. And it's the journey getting there that we like to read about. If someone said like, oh, the wall comes down, but Jon sacrifices himself and Dany becomes the queen of the 12 kingdoms or islands that are left, you know, okay, that's great, but we want to know how it gets there. And it sucks waiting, but we have to wait, and that's fine. But we also are allowed to be frustrated sometimes.
I do think there is a way that he can get from where we are at the end of A Dance with Dragons to some kind of ending that is both satisfying and doesn't feel rushed. I couldn't tell you what that way is. It's going to take some seriously virtuoso storytelling to get there from here and feel like it all works and makes sense. But I think it's possible. You know, I haven't given up hope that there is some kind of path forward here that doesn't feel like it's skipping through things or just ignoring the sort of the dominoes that have been set up. I think that, I don't know, it does feel a little bit like things are kind of coalescing finally. Yeah. But yeah.
And I don't think he would publish a book that is subpar in his opinion. You know, he wouldn't do that, or you shouldn't do that.
I think there's a lot of evidence even in A Dance with Dragons that this can all be pulled off successfully. And perhaps in my heart, because it's probably one of my favorite chapters in the entire book, the epilogue of A Dance with Dragons is like it's quick, it's dramatic, it sets up like a lot of things are happening at the same time. It advances time and the plot pretty dramatically in a fairly short chapter. Like that's really the kind of chapters he needs to write if he wants to, you know, one, start aging up his characters, two, start making events move into place the way he needs. And I think there's certain constraints of the world, like fighting wars during winter, or like I have to imagine sort of like the Winterfell under siege chapters from A Dance of Dragons, that the pace of events have to just kind of slow down because winter is occurring, right? Like you're not going to march your 20,000 men out and fight long battles and protracted campaigns when there's 7 feet of snow on the ground.
No, like, what did they do in the Middle Ages? They literally waited until the spring to fight.
Right.
And they don't have the luxury to do that because we know it could last years. So.
Right. So maybe that'll help the pacing in that, like, there's not going to be a battle for everyone to be reacting to every single month, or like new events just can't occur at the same pace that they did in the previous books when it was summer and autumn.
So you're saying that will give him more leeway to do a more drastic jumps or skips, you think?
Yeah, I guess so.
It could, as long as he doesn't like revisit. So the thing with the Winterfell is he revisits it quite a bit. There's a lot of POV chapters in those sections, or at least I remember them being. So, you know, over all of those, it might have covered a long time while it took Stannis to march down from the wall. But, you know, you could have covered those in fewer chapters with the same amount of time, because we're all just sitting here and the Freys and the Boltons and the other Northern Lords are slowly turning on each other without showing it all in, you know, quote unquote, real time.
Well, that's why I hope that there'll be some sort of gap or like space between a book, you know, like a book one or section one and section two, where, because we know he's basically written the Battle of Fire. Parts of that were supposed to be in Dance, and for various reasons they were moved. So like we know there can't be a time jump then, but maybe after those two battles are resolved, maybe there can be a big time jump and take it from there. But
I would have no problem if after the time jump it was, you know, 3 years later and
Danny's in,
like, everyone's kind of hunkered down. Dany is ready to launch her army finally, like everything is prepared, like that's why there's been this wait. And but Aegon in the meantime has established himself as like the Targaryen and Southern Westeros, and the King's Landing plot is the King's Landing plot of like torture and misery and oppression, you know, basically a tyranny. Yep. And, you know, you still have the Riverlands falling apart, but it's also winter. So you get lots of good small folk in rebellion against their lords sort of situation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're at, you know, as soon as these immediate conflicts are resolved after the end of the Dance with the Dragons, we're at a very good point, I think, with all of the characters where some kind of gap would be warranted. I think for me, the one character, I mean, you know, there's a couple other ones that I think it's nice to get a little more out of. But for me, the one character that gives me pause on the, you know, the initial 5-year gap after A Storm of Swords is Jaime. I think that his arc would completely be lost if we skipped ahead the sort of the more interesting parts of his development. And I don't necessarily feel that way with any character, I don't think, at the end of Dance, you know, after these immediate conflicts are resolved.
As long as it opens with Davos on Skagos, I'm fine.
So why do you think, why Jaime in particular, or why do you feel you couldn't get that in flashback or some other way? And bear in mind, I love Jaime, so I kind of agree I want more Jaime, but...
I think that the point that we have him at the end of A Storm of Swords and sort of his development from there it just wouldn't be the same if he had 5 years to sort of cope with the changes in his life that he was kind of, you know, maybe he's not settled with it, you know, that could be the case too, but it just wouldn't be as interesting if he was at the point where he was comfortable with the way he is now, 5 years later.
Late introduction too. He was one of the last characters introduced in that, you know, of the original characters.
I agree with you, Zach. I don't think you could have Jaime at court with Cersei for 3 or 5 years and not show his character development. The only way I could imagine that is if, like, he's basically in charge of the army sitting on the Riverlands, or they send him to Casterly Rock and he kind of just, he's waiting, essentially. But you're right. He's one of those characters that would be hurt by a time slip. Though, I don't think we've made this point specifically, and I kind of want to do, and it's easy as book fans to cast shade upon the show, but I think one of the things the show did well and it wasn't on purpose, was because we have human actors in a live action play, the children grew up naturally.
Yeah.
So when they embraced the age of the actor and let them essentially play closer to their real age, the show worked very strongly. But whenever they had to interject the supposed narrative age of the actor, it often fell apart. Like, so for example, I think they pretty much abandoned Bran as a child. The actor has simply grown up too much. Okay. They can't pretend. Like, I don't think they pretend anymore that he's supposed to be 10, because he's clearly like a teenager.
Also, his age is irrelevant to his storyline.
So yeah. By implication, yeah. Are there multiple different simultaneous timelines going on? Like, so Bran's aging faster than Cersei. I mean, not that it impacts the show, but just like, if you really, really looked at it, that would kind of be the assumption.
So the one thing, I'll put it this way, one character I think really who would benefit from a natural time progression, and the show proved this out to a certain extent, is Sansa. Because like, as she develops, as she develops into a more cunning, capable, and mature woman, you can see like how she starts to get the upper hand on Littlefinger, how she can take leadership and it doesn't seem ridiculous. Though there was a scene in season 5, I believe, where Sophie Turner, the actress, if I've done the math correctly here in my head, was 18. And I think she tells one of the ladies of the Vale that she's 12. And it's just completely mind-boggling. It might have been 13 or 14, but like,
that's silly, because they were aged up in the show anyway. So if she was 12, she would have been older than that in the show.
I might be wrong on the age, but like, young adolescent. And it's like, Sophie Turner is a young woman. The line coming out of her mouth, like, someone should have said, cut, we're changing this. It's like, no, say I am a maid or something, like, not what it is. But the show kind of gives the proof that if you age up the Stark characters, it makes sense. Like, I can't imagine little 10, 11-year-old Arya slitting throats across Westeros. But Maisie Williams is 20 years old, so I'm a little more comfortable observing those scenes. And as we said, the Mercy chapter really makes that point clear.
Yeah. I think the show, in a way, has an advantage in that, you know, both the fact that it is a visual medium, and just the simple fact that it's not held to the same sort of rigorous standard of timeline, you know, being very, very clearly laid out. You know, it can be more cavalier with like the time skips that happen. You can say that the war went on for years when it clearly doesn't make sense for some characters, but you know, it does help advance others to the point where they're supposed to be. I think in a way that helps it, and, you know, in other ways it hurts it, obviously, but that allows it to sort of make these moves towards you know, different phases in these characters, whereas George feels like he has to plod his way there with the books.
So I'm just looking at the list of character ages again. At the start of the series, Jon is 14, Sansa's 11, Arya's 9, Bran is 7, Daenerys is 13, Tommen is 6, Marcella's 7, and Rickon is 2. I look at all those ages and I say, you add 7 years to them, you know, 2 for the natural progression of the story and 5 for a gap or like a slip, all of them benefit. I don't think there's any one of them I'm like, no, it doesn't make sense if Daenerys is 20 years old when she comes to conquer Westeros.
Yeah, and you know what? If he committed to that early on and like this is going to happen, he could have probably worked out, you know, the problematic ones, a Cersei or some of the, you know, like, well, not Ned because he'd be dead, but, you know, a Jaime. And of course he could have made it. He's a brilliant writer and he could have made that work. It's too late in the game. You know, it's interesting to talk about it and I'm glad we did talk about it, but I think it just shines a light on the fact that it would have been a completely different series if he had done that from a narrative point of view.
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this and do this episode is in the last few Vox, there's been a lot of griping about the state of publication.
Yeah, and that's me. It's all me. I apologize.
It's not you, Bina, alone. Like, there are lots of people.
It's a lot of me, though. I do apologize.
The one that stands out in my mind, I don't think you were even on. So you're okay. And just like assigning weird motives to it. So I kind of wanted to talk about like, what are the writing problems here? Because we talk about George is having writing problems. So let's actually talk about one of the concrete issues he could be having with his story.
Yeah, and that's probably why I feel better about life now, because I actually feel sympathy for him. Because it isn't easy and there aren't obvious solutions. It's very well for me to say, oh, go back and retrospectively have a better pace. But these are real thorny issues and one of the most complicated books series of all time. So I get it.
I also think that there's a point where you know, you have the feel for it, just kind of naturally, like where you feel this character should go. And when you lose that, it's so hard to get it back. And I feel like
maybe
the case for a lot of this.
Especially because if they don't fit together, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is what should happen with Danny. This is what should happen for John. Oh, so am I going to have 7 Cersei chapters in a row showing what's happening while John, like, readies the wall and Danny governs a city over the course of several seasons? Like what are we...
Well, that's where your time slips could, you know, where certain characters have skips and jumps and some don't.
Right. Because there's like a...
We solved the problem and George has to listen to this and then we're good. So
yeah, if George just listened to Volk, shit would be so much better.
And like, I'm super sensitive. Like, anytime I say like George should or he, you know, like I'm talking out of my ass. Like, I don't actually mean he should do this. I just talk like in the context.
I completely agree. And no,
you know,
one...
Because I'm the less... Yeah. I never want it to be that. Because like, I remember when Neil Gaiman wrote that article about, you know, how George Martin is not your bitch. And I was like, of course. Yeah. People can be frustrated. But like, the second you start telling him what to do or he should do this, like, no, he shouldn't. He should do exactly whatever he ends up...
Yeah. No one believes in personal liberty more than me. So he's not obliged to us in any way, shape or form. And I actually, you know what? Part of my anger over this is, or sadness over this is, I just feel he's not happy. I feel he's not happy with this creation that has given us such joy. And he's troubled by it. And that's part of the reason he can't go forward. And that makes me sad. It really does. Even if it is choices he's made, like selling to HBO. Because we all make choices in life that we don't foresee the consequences of and get mired in stuff. It's actually his problem with the book is like epic and famous. But it is a very good analogy for stuff we get into in life, where you take these little choices, they seem good, and then suddenly you're, you know, locked in a corner and you don't quite know where to begin to get out. And it's very relatable to me, even though I'm not remotely creative whatsoever.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's so bad when something that you're enthusiastic about becomes an obligation. And just I couldn't even fathom the level of obligation he has to deal with here. You know, the amount of people that are, you know, relying on him or hoping that he'll do this seems so, you know, so hard to deal with. Like, yeah. I couldn't even imagine.
And there must be so many people in jobs that they started off loving and then the mortgage comes and the family comes and suddenly it becomes an obligation and it kind of morphs subtly. The company maybe gets taken over, it becomes bigger, different, and suddenly you hate it and you can't get the will to get up in the morning. And I just think this is very relatable.
I think in terms of writers, I felt like he's made comments about what has happened in the published books that he wish he could go back and tinker with. I think if he followed Tolkien's road and spent the 20 years writing this in private and then started publishing it, it would be in a place that he'd be much more satisfied with, because he could go back and say, okay, by book six, I noticed it's bad that I haven't aged these characters up more. So I need to space out the pace of events in the first three so that they have, you know, a little more time. Or because he can't go back and tinker, because people have creepily committed these books to memory.
Yep.
Right?
Like, it's canon. And I think it's just not
realistic,
is...
though, right, for a professional writer to just like take a break for 20 years and, you know, wait until you're ready. It's just not realistic.
No, absolutely.
And that's the point.
That's the point you said.
Tolkien had the luxury of doing that because his real job was being a professor of literature and language at Oxford. And so he could take 20 years, because although this was great, it was a side thing for him.
Yeah. And he did take 25 years between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and he, you know, never finished the Silmarillion. So
It was his side hustle, and he just, you know, made it work, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's kind of a joke in professional writing circles that, like, the person who has a manuscript in their desk that they've been tinkering with for 15 years isn't a writer, they're a person who edits. You know, a real writer publishes their work. The person with one story they've been working on for years and years isn't really working. Like, they,
you know. But in, like, general, you know, quote-unquote literary fiction, you do have authors that will, you know, Donna Tartt, you know, she'll put out a book every 12 years. You know, she won the Pulitzer Prize a couple years ago, you know, and it's expected some authors will take 15 years to write one book.
Well, look at Aaron Duthie Roy, right?
Six a year, you know? Yeah. I was just going to bring that up, you know. 15 years between books, and what did she say? She said that, you know, fiction takes time, and she couldn't write it before it was ready to be written.
But also, she's been off doing things like, you know, political agitation and activism, and that's, I've just received the book today, actually, but apparently that all gets reflected in the book, so I respect that too. I mean, people need to do what they need to do, but she's amazing, right? To write two books that could potentially both win the Booker, it's pretty freaking awesome.
And then you have scary freak writers like Stephen King who do their magnum opus and still pump out like a book a year.
Well, right. He I've told this before, in the 70s and 80s, he was writing four or five books a year. And then, like, he slowed down, you know, he got hit by a car, he got addicted to pain meds. And now he's, you know, doing two books a year. But sometimes he does three, sometimes he does five. Right. And now they just reissued it in hardcover, and they just reissued The Dark Tower in hardcover. So, like, he's going to have two more bestsellers of books that he already wrote 20, 30 years ago that he didn't even do a new intro for.
The thing I find interesting about King, though, I haven't read much.
We could do a whole other podcast on Stephen King.
Perhaps we should put a note on that one. Is that like, he did write his big epic story, the Dark Tower, and he still produced books like on the regular.
Well, because there's many reasons, but those books were tied into his regular books. You know, Salem Plot plays a part in The Dark Tower. The Stand is a huge part of The Dark Tower. And a large portion of his oeuvre is connected. Mm-hmm. And most authors don't have that.
Absolutely. It's true.
I just want to bring up one thing that I was just, because I watched, I don't know if anyone else saw the Grateful Dead documentary, A Long Straight Trip. I'm a big Grateful Dead fan. And one of the things that they talked about Jerry Garcia towards the end of his life is that he couldn't enjoy music anymore. He couldn't go to concerts because he was always hounded by the press and by fans. And he didn't have a band that he could go see and enjoy. He didn't have a Grateful Dead in his life, you know, a band that he could go to. And I think on a smaller scale, probably with George, is that, like, he's talked about how he can't go to Comic-Con anymore and just walk the halls. And, you know, he's George R. R. Martin, you know, and that's super sad to me, because I know the joy that I get when I go to Ice and Fire Con, or I, you know, get to talk to you guys, or, you know, and if he doesn't have that in his life where he can't just be a fan, maybe that's contributed to it.
And isn't it an awful, ironic, vicious circle whereby we love what he's given us so much, we're clamoring for more, and our very clamoring is creating the conditions whereby he can't produce it.
Yeah.
And that's just awful. That's so sad.
I think there's an alternate timeline where George said no, or HBO never heard of A Song of Ice and Fire, and he quietly and very successfully within his genre, but not in mainstream, completed the books. Perhaps, you know, maybe they'd even be done by now or a couple of years from now, because without the extra attention and the pressure. And years later, they did get discovered and adapted to, like, a massive fanfare, kind of almost like a Tolkien-like scenario, rather than the life he has currently been leading, which would have, like, to me, that's almost like the dream. Like, he would have seen his work loved and appreciated in a huge way and completed them probably the way he would have preferred.
And Bina, if you don't use the Grateful Dead song Dire Wolf in the opening, I'll never forgive you.
I was actually going to use Elvis Costello Every Day I Write a Book as the outro music.
That's right.
But if I can get the Grateful Dead song.
They're pretty litigious on their copyright, really? So you might not want to.
Okay, so I probably won't then. Okay.
But whatever they do feels have a song called Dire Wolf,
so it's appropriate.
Cool.
So thank you very much, Zach, Greg, and Bina, for joining me to discuss the 5-year gap. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more of Vassals of Kingsgrave on iTunes or whatever podcast service you enjoy. You can find us on YouTube, or you can come join us on the forums at A Podcast of Ice and Fire. Thank you very much. Sorry, I'm just nervous. I haven't done this in a long time.
Aw, we'll be gentle.
Okay.
If I do a bad enough job, you won't release it, and it'll be perfect.
I mean, basically, I don't really care if anyone ever listens to this. I just want to chat about the stuff with you guys. So
yeah, I just wanted to talk about this. I didn't need to do recorded episodes.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to talk.
Oh, good. I'm going to eat them.
whatever you do. Up.
Stop trying.
Eating is very much in the wheelhouse of Vok, though. Eating and drinking sounds.
I don't. There's a certain subgenre of episode that should be tagged clinking ice cubes.
I think it is, and I think that's what the volley tag signifies.
Well, there's a few where it's like, I don't know if Greg was hosting those ones, but there's your presence is very strong, Greg. It's like every time you interject, there's the sound of clinking ice.
Also slurping.
Yeah.
I try not to slurp.
In the Conan sort of the DVD commentary, you can definitely hear me eating my cornflakes over the first half hour of that. So we recorded this on stupid early time.
And that second dollop, I think you can hear being a fall asleep into your pizza.
Yeah. And then wake up jarringly 2 minutes before the end.
What happened?
It's a good job I wasn't snoring. Or maybe I wasn't, you just kindly edited it out.
Oh yeah, I have those tracks saved.
Blackmail.
It's my favorite kind of mail. Okay, let's see if I can do an intro off the cuff. Let's see if I can do it. I'm stretching. I don't know if that helps.
Just do it in a British accent, you'll find. Everything's better with a British accent.
Welcome back, and you're listening to The Vassals of Kingsgrave.
Oh, I like you go for like the upper class accent. I go straight for the more on the Cockney end.
Listen, like, yeah, North Americans hard into Cockney when they do an English accent, so I like to mix it up.
Well, since Downton Abbey, I think I go more for the Yorkshire accent. We'll see if it pops up. Probably won't.
Okay. Hello, everyone.
So God
damn.
I literally heard your intake breath. I pictured you like, oh, let's do this.
Oh, I'm shattered now, you bastard.
Rock is a tough place, I tell you.
Happy to be talking about Twin Peaks again, Lance. Let's get down.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's wrap this up.
Let's record Twin Peaks episode 12. The Return. Okay. Greg, don't you dare say a word.
Ever?
Do we do the introductions first, or do I have to explain what we're talking about first?
Do you not remember how this works, Stephen? Come on.
It doesn't matter, whichever way you like.
Your own.
Okay.
Do the intros at the end.
So, like, should I give the formal thank you for listening?
Yep.
Yes, in your British accent, please.
I'm too nervous doing a British accent in front of Bina. I know she judges our foul
I do my mouth. British accent in front of Bina all the time. She's not offended.
I mean, Stephen, like, if I was offended by people's British accents and indeed imitations of me, I would have, like, quit VOK years ago.
Listen, there's just so much pressure. It's like, oh no, Bina's listening to my... Like, listen, the North American butchery of the English accent is shameful and an entire industry in Hollywood. Like, we cannot... We cannot abide by it when a person is in the room, for God's sake.
Well, there is a really fun like party game I just found out about called Utter Nonsense, where it kind of forces you to do different accents and say things. But I highly recommend that if you want to practice up on your accents. Available at Southampton Books.
I don't know if I revealed this. Where other five board games are sold. I don't know if I revealed this on one of the FCRs we did, but I practiced trying to do a Northern English accent. I listened to like videos of how to do it, and I tried to imitate the vowel sounds.
I mean, I think it's all very impressive. Like, I can't do a Northern accent, and I'm from England. I can barely do any regional accent. So, you know, rock and roll, you guys. Take it away.